Okay, Esther chapter 8, and we'll get through these chapters because this is more of a narrative. We've really dealt with a lot of the, there's some, but we've dealt with a lot of, hopefully you've seen how God has worked things out. And what you're going to see, hopefully by the time we finish this, let me say it now in case I forget at the end, is that this whole thing with Esther and Mordecai did not just happen in a vacuum. Nor is it a one-time event. But hopefully, as we talked at the beginning of this, you'll see that God used Esther and Mordecai and put them both in prominent positions because God is about to raise up a man by the name of Nehemiah. And remember that we said that Artaxerxes is the stepson of Esther, and Artaxerxes is the king that allows Nehemiah to go back to the land and rebuild the city of Jerusalem and stuff. So God is, God is putting these Jewish people in prominent places in the Medo-Persian Empire in order that they may be able to go back and fulfill the will of God. So I want you to see God's hand. That's the key here. You see God's hand in all of this. So chapter 8, and we finished last week with Haman being hanged on his own gallows, put to death on his own gallows. So, chapter 8, on the day that King Artaxerxes gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jew, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So, everything's sort of been put out in the open now. All this was kind of, remember, before. And again, it's not information the king would have even needed before this time. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And this is a very interesting thing. Mordecai is raised to the place of great prominence. He is wearing the ring of the king, which means he has the authority of the king in the same way that Haman did. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. So Esther gave Mordecai the house of Haman, which we would guess would have been quite a place. You know Haman, number two in the kingdom. He wasn't living in a shack. So, and he was very proud of everything that he had. So now Mordecai, who we don't know had much of anything, now all of a sudden is exalted to not only the position, but all that goes along with that position has been given to him. Verse 4, and the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king. Verse 3, I skipped one. Now Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil plot of Haman, the Agagite, and the scheme which had been devised against the Jews. So remember what Haman had done. We've already talked about that. But Esther is not through pleading with the king to somehow stop this from happening, because the decree is basically to exterminate every Jew in the world, in the known world at that time, which again would include by necessity Queen Esther and Mordecai. Alright, so she again places herself, again according to the law, in a place of harm because she falls before the king here without the king calling her and saying, I want you to come talk to me. So look at what the king does. Once again, the king in verse 4 holds out his scepter, which is the only way we've talked about that you can come before the king without being called and not being punished actually by death. So verse 5 now, and it said, and if it please the king, and if I have found favor in your sight, and the thing seems right to the king, I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of, and you know that word there, so which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in the king's provinces. Again, I remind you, the king's provinces are the world, the known world at that time. The Medo-Persian Empire was all of the world at that time. Verse 6, for how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people, and how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? So her request is, and it makes sense. She's calling out to the king for her people. And if there's any way possible that he could retract the decree. Now, again, we've talked about the law of the Medes and the Persians. So even the king, when he makes such a decree, he cannot retract the decree. It has to happen the way it has already been written. Which, again, tells you something. You'll remember, very quickly, you'll remember in the book of Daniel that God gave Daniel this image of the multi-metallic image, and it started with the head of gold, and we talked about that was Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon. And remember, Nebuchadnezzar answered to nobody. I mean, he could say one thing one day and the next day, and it wouldn't make a difference. Time we get to the Medes and Persians, which is silver, which is a lower grade, we found out that by necessity, because it really was a split kingdom, the Medes and the Persian, that the law itself had to actually set over the king. So the Medo-Persian kings were not sovereigns in the same way that Nebuchadnezzar was sovereign. They too had to adhere to the written or the established law. We saw that with Darius, with Daniel in the lion's den. We see it here also. And so, but she's pleading. Okay? Now verse 7. Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, "Indeed I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. You yourself write a decree for the Jews, as you please, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For a letter which is written in the king's name and sealed in the king's signet ring, no one can revoke." So, now we're going to have... Well, this sounds like Washington. We're going to have two contesting decrees. One written by a man who hated the Jews and wanted to annihilate the Jews, and one written by a man who wants to do his best to preserve the Jewish people. Now, how is this going to work out? This is going to be an interesting thing to see how this works out. So let's see how this does work out. So verse 9. So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, in the 23rd day, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded. To the Jews, the satraps, the governors, the princes of the provinces from India to Ethiopia. That's quite a span there. You look on the map, what we know. Again, that's pretty much the known world at that time. And it would certainly be the world where you would find Jewish people. Quite clearly, we know that China existed at that time, but the scope of where the Jewish people were, even though they were taken in captivity, would have been within the realm that's written about right here. Okay, so all the officials of the king were going to get this decree, and it was going to carry. It's interesting. It's going to carry the same weight as Haman's decree. Okay, they're laws. They're written into law. They'll carry the exact same weight. Not one has more than the other. Okay, so to every province in his own script, to every people in their own language. Why would it say that? You remember? Because the Medo-Persian Empire was a compilation of all kinds of different ethnic groups and language groups. And again, they were allowed, if you will, to keep their ethnic identity or their language identity and stuff. They just had to give their allegiance to whoever was sitting on the throne in the empire at that time. So it goes on to say, and to the Jews in their own script and language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent the letters by couriers on horseback, riding on royal horses, bred for swift steeds. That almost sounds like a, you know, that's pretty good writing right there. So, swift horses. These were the best. And this is first Pony Express that you see happening right here. Going out, making sure that the word gets out to everybody. So, remember what had happened with Haman's decree. Well, in a 12-month time, remember they cast the lots to determine when it would be enacted. And we talked about how, again, we see God's sovereign hand there. I mean, they could have cast the lots and it could have been enacted in 2 months. It could have been enacted in 1 month. Okay? But by coincidence, You know I don't mean that. 13 months later. So God allowed for all this to happen, including not only the demise of Haman and the exaltation of Mordecai, but also time to write what needed to be written and for it to get out there before that tragic day was to come about. Okay, which in that day, basically it was, you are to take your swords and you are to go into your communities and you are to kill anybody and everybody who is Jewish. That was the decree. All right, so verse 11, by these letters the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and to protect their lives. So he is giving them permission, basically, to take up arms. He has given them permission to defend themselves. Okay? So, what would have been clear is that first decree would almost be, you're going to be defenseless. Or they are defenseless. Or maybe it's already been established that you're not allowed to carry arms. You're not allowed to particularly defend yourself against an established decree of the king. It's interesting. The first decree would include everybody in the kingdom, which would include the Jews. In other words, they were required as members of the kingdom to observe the decree too. For them, it would be to give themselves to that. Okay. Now, this new decree is saying to them, you have the right to defend yourself. You have the right to arm yourself. And it says there, to protect your lives. Okay? So, goes on to say in the middle of verse 11, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both their children and women, and their plunder, and plunder their possessions. This is the craziest thing if you really start to think about it. You're turning the kingdom against itself. It may be the result of just a bad system, first of all. Certainly the result of making bad decrees before you really think out the full impact of those decrees. The system saying, you know what, we can't even change a bad law. That's a bad system. Okay? So, but that's what the system is. So what do you do when you find out you have established a bad law and you can't change it? Well, then you try to make another law to counteract that law. But in the midst of all this, what you're going to have, think about it, what you're going to have is innocent people killed. One way or another, you're going to have innocent people killed. Which again, ought to give us a little bit of warning. And when you have people who make laws that do not think them through, or make laws that are not really according for the good of the whole of the people, you've got real issues that come from that. And the only way you can fix that is to establish more bad laws, apparently. Or have a heart change. So, look at the two decrees. The first decree is everybody take up arms and kill everybody that's Jewish. The second decree is everybody who's Jewish take up arms and kill people who are trying to kill you. He's because of this bad system and these bad decrees, he's established war in his own kingdom. Okay? Do you see that? Alright. Verse 12. On one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, a copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province and published to all the people, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. Then the couriers who rode on royal horses went out, hastened, and pressed on by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Shushan, the citadel. Okay, so they're not really, if you want to say it, they're not really given the right to bear arms all the time, but it's on that day. Maxine,
would you call that a civil war then, because it is between two factions?
It certainly would be a civil war. It certainly would be a civil war, because again, from the king's view, everybody involved in this belongs to him. Or belongs to the kingdom. It's interesting that it's the king himself that's creating the civil war. Okay, So, but again, I want you to notice here that they're not given the right to do this all the time. The sense is just for this occasion. Okay. On a smaller scale, we're warned by Jesus himself, and then later on James warns us, said we need to be very careful that we don't make vows very, or commitments or promises very lightly. We're actually warned against making vows in that sense. He says, you know, you just need to let your yes be your yes and your no be your no. And you know, to raise it to the level of a vow or a commit or a promise, to the sense of that ought to be taken, that ought to be very I don't want to say a very rare thing. Jesus teaches us to be people of integrity, that if we say we're going to do something, we do it. Okay. But even in that, we need to be very careful to think it through before we say we'll do something, before we make a commitment to somebody. And again, not to raise in the Bible, the level of the vow, you need to understand, the level of the vow in the Bible is that no matter what, you don't break it. That's what that vow means. And you see that in the Old Testament, and you see the, you know, so for us, we would say we need to let our yes be yes, or no be no. And part of being a person of integrity is, let's say something comes along, we said we would do something, something comes along and we can't. Part of integrity is to go to that person and say, you know what, I had every intent to do this, but it's out of my control, I can't do this. That's part of the honesty there too. But you know what, if you do that every time you commit to something, then, you know, so be very careful. That becomes the point there. Because again, what you're going to see is innocent people are going to die because of just bad thinking and bad decrees and stuff. It's interesting that those who are in charge, maybe it's the way of the world, guys. Maybe it's what war is all about in so many cases. Those who are in charge send those others to die for the decrees that they make. And I understand that there are sometimes you have to do that because there is evil in the world. I understand that. But I also understand, I'm not so naive not to believe that some of this, and a lot of it maybe, is just caused because people have made statements and other people have made statements and they get mad at each other and say, well, I'll send my guys over to fight your guys. That's happened too. We just have to be honest about that. So, you know, the kings and the lawmakers make all these decisions that impact people who have no say in it. Maybe that's the way of the world and the system of the world. Huh?
Sounds familiar.
Well, it's history over and over and over again. Nothing's changed. You know? Okay, so verse 15. Now Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment from fine linen and purple, and the city of Susan rejoiced and was glad. It looked a little bit different than he did in the sackcloth and ashes and stuff, you know. Boy, how things have changed. But notice that the city is rejoicing about this. And verse 16, the Jews and had light and gladness, joy and honor. And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews because a fear of the Jews fell upon them. So what does that tell you? Well, let's just deal with the reality of life. A majority of people are going to go whichever way the wind blows. Everybody got that? Whatever benefits them. And that's what's happening here. They see that the Jews have been given a special place from the king and an ability to do something that no other ethnic group we know has ability to do, to actually stand up and defend themselves within the realm of the kingdom. Okay? And so, you know, say, well, hey, that seems like a privileged group. Everybody wants to be a part of a privileged group, right? And that's exactly what happened here. So interesting that they became Jews, and we would say, you say, well, how do you become a Jew? You understand, even today, you can become a religious Jew You can begin to practice the Jewish faith today without being an ethnic Jew. Okay? Sunday.
Well, obviously it's kind of going to negate what they said that they did out here, but I find it interesting in the fact that people have different personalities, and the original decree was that no matter what, you needed to kill. So if you were forced to do something, even if it was against maybe your own morals, that was your best friend, whatever. So now they're in a situation where if they go the other side, they actually don't have to act out. They only have to act in defense, because here the Jews are not actually going to be going and murdering themselves. They're only going to be defending their life if they are attacked. So there
right.
really shouldn't be any type of war here. It's only the accuser that causes this war.
Right.
Whereas now you have those that if they flip to the other side, they no longer have to be the accuser. They can just be the defender. So
right. Part of this got to be, the air has to be taken out of the balloon to some extent here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean by that? You know, when you were hyped up and stuff just to go out and slaughter. I know it sounds bad, but when you were hyped up just to go out and slaughter, and you know it's easy pickings. Then all of a sudden it's not easy pickings. Then you're going to start thinking, well, do I really want to do this? I mean, do I want to put my life on the line for a guy that was made a decree that he's no more? I mean, all of those, we can't take this out of the realm of real life, because you gotta think these people are thinking some of this. So, all right, let's go to chapter 9. So now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, the 13th day, the time came for the king's command, his decree, to be executed. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred, in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. So the war, if you will, the civil war, has been said, has begun right on that day. This is such a tragedy. If you just stop and think of it, it's a needless... Anyways. Verse 2, the Jews gathered together in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could withstand them, because fear of them fell upon all people. Now, what that last little phrase there, let's not run by it too quickly, because I think you also have to see, we go back to God's hand in all of this. Certainly the Jews were not the majority. Okay, but would also tell you that not everybody in the kingdom was taking up swords to kill the Jews. Okay, but God worked in them, I think, to bring fear upon those who come. It's not the first time it's happened in the scripture, where God supernaturally brings fear into the heart of the enemies of his people, and I think this happens here again. And again, I think a lot of the fight was taken out when a new decree was made. And when, you know, it's one thing to walk into somebody's house, I guess, and you know that they're unarmed and you can just take the life. It's another thing to walk in their house and they're standing there armed and ready, waiting for you. It's a whole different, you know, dynamic that is there. So, but please don't take out the fear of the Lord that he might put in the hearts of these people who are going to annihilate. And so they're consumed with fear and they're backing off. Okay? Verse 3, and all the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and all those doing the king's work helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. So what is happening here? They're having to make a decision. Right? All these satraps and governors, they're having to make a decision. They're seeing, as Maxine, as you said, they're seeing the civil war taking place. They're standing there as officials seeing it and said, you know what? Guess who's number two to Xerxes? And when this day is over, guess who number two is? And guess who we're going to have to answer to? Not Haman. Haman's gone. I think you can be assured, if Haman was still there, it would have been a different story. But they're looking at the reality of the situation, and they realize that when all this is said and done, when this day of slaughter and these days of civil war are over, there's going to be one man they're going to answer to. It's going to be Mordecai. So, yes.
They also saw those previous verses in the last part of 8 that, as the saying goes, nothing succeeds like success. They saw what a wonderful celebration they were having and how many positive things were going on in their lives. So that influenced them also. They saw that they were successful.
I think there's a lot of that going on. You have to sit back and say, well, first of all, what are we fighting for? Why are we killing these people? Actually, the reason we're killing these people is gone. We're doing it because it's already been decreed. And again, when everything's said and done, Mordecai is going to be the one we answer to. And so, well, let's go on. Verse 4, it says, "For Mordecai was great in the king's palace, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for this man Mordecai became increasingly prominent." So you can see that, you can say the political influence and stuff of Mordecai now, and the power that he has, and they realized that they were going to have to answer to him. All right? Verse 5. "Thus the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them." So this was an ugly, ugly, bloody, unnecessary slaughter. And the slaughter was going, here's what you need, because of the bad decision, the slaughter was going to take place one way or another. It was either going to be all the Jews were going to be slaughtered, or the Jews were going to be able to defend themselves against those who hated them, and the slaughter was going to take place that way. But you see the effect of just bad decisions, and hopefully you see the effect of hate. Now notice what actually happens here. Who did the hate consume? There's a bigger picture here I want you to see than the actual events. Who did the hate in this case, in this biblical account, who did the hate consume? Well, first of all, Haman's hate consumed him. Not only did it consume him, Haman's hate consumed his family. Okay? His family was gone too. They were killed with him. Okay? And now those who hated the Jews, who thought they would go and destroy them, their hate that drove them to continue to do this, who did it consume? Them. You understand that's what hate does? Initially what hate does, what hate will always do, initially what it will do is it will consume the hater. And then it moves on beyond that. Because hate left unchecked will not only consume the hater, but it will affect a lot of innocent people. And that's exactly, I mean, that if you want to get a message out of this part of this, I think it's an important message that we get. To be driven by hate is always destructive. It's always destructive. And I think it reminds us why the Bible tells us that God is love. It's just the opposite of that. And that we are to be people of love. That doesn't mean we don't make strong stands. It doesn't. And there's a whole, I don't want to go into all the aspects of that. But we always have to check our hearts as to what's driving us. Is it just pure hate? Because if it's pure hate that's driving you, then your soul is being, you need to understand, your soul is being destroyed. You might get something accomplished by that, but your soul itself is being destroyed. And then innocent people who are around you, they're being affected, and some of them destroyed by that too. That's what it's talking about right here. Don't ever want to be driven by hate. Don't ever want to be driven by that force of hate. Okay. Sunday.
I think that goes back and reconfirms how it's a spiritual battle, and the fact that obviously Satan hates Jesus.
Yeah.
God, and that this is where it's all just stirring.
If you think about Satan, I take it a little bit further than that. He hates Jesus. He hates the people of God. I think you can make a great case for he hates the creation of God. That he wants to see, destruction of people. He wants the destruction of homes and families and communities and societies. Even, and I'm saying this even to those who don't know Jesus yet. Satan, I think we have to remember that God's grace and God's love is, I want you to understand this, it's all-encompassing in the sense that all mankind is under the grace of God. If all mankind was not under the grace of God, we would implode. I'm not saying that to say that everybody is saved. But the world does not know yet what it would be like for God's grace to be raised up off of humanity. You understand what I'm saying? The difference of what I'm saying there? I'm not talking about, quote, specific grace that brings one to salvation. I'm talking about this world is under the umbrella of God's grace. And if it wasn't, this world would be already been destroyed long ago. So what you need to understand, I think, is that it is Satan's intent and his hateful heart that he not only wants to destroy, he not only hates Jesus and wants to destroy the works of Jesus or the people of Jesus or the church of Jesus, he wants to destroy whole societies. And that's what's happening around us all the time, folks. And remember, as Sonny said, it's a spiritual battle. We want to bring it down to a physical plane, but if we're going to have victory in any of these battles, we need to fight it at the source. And a few months ago, I shared a message out of Ephesians chapter 6, where and my point was, the enemy of our souls wants to get us off of where the real battle is. They might want us to get us to hate this group or that group or this movement or that movement. And again, I would say we need to stand against those things in the truth, but we need to understand where the battle actually is. If we're not careful, we're all fighting this fire and that fire and that fire while everything's being consumed by the enemy. Because Paul reminds us that in Ephesians chapter 6 that our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and power and spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places. And if we don't fight there, then he's got us sort of diverted.
So then does that go back to help support what you're saying, that we struggle with the physical? And so you say that our biggest sin is what? When we step out and we live in the flesh.
We live in the flesh, yeah.
So once we live in the flesh, then we become part of the physical, which is the ruler of this domain of earth is not, I mean, as much as Jesus is right now, he's allowed Satan to have domain over this.
Right.
So the minute that we step out of the spiritual world into the fleshly world, then we can succumb to him and start to be battling these other battles which are a flesh and blood.
Right.
Which is, if we stay in the spirit, then we're not as susceptible to him.
Yeah, remember this, that he can't have you. You belong to the Lord if you're born again. He can't have you. But when we step into the flesh, we open the door to him and we give him influence. And sometimes that influence is he actually becomes the one that's directing us. Not because he has that authority. He doesn't. But if you and I open the door to him and let him come in, then we're saying we're being responsive to him. Sue, were you going to say something?
I was just going to say along those lines, and this hate, I think, keeps us in the temporal. So the fear is of the king and the Jews, not of God. So instead of having your focus on eternal and the fear of God, it keeps your focus on the fear of things that can't help you. It keeps you almost a prisoner of the temporal. And I think we struggle with that today.
And I think Satan loves that. I think Satan loves for the church to be so focused. And I've shared this before where I've heard preachers say, you know, the problem with the church is it's so heavenly minded it's no earthly good. And my point would be, I don't believe that at all. I believe the problem with the church is it's too earthly minded. Because as we become heavenly minded, that's led by the Holy Spirit, that's when we become earthly good. Because again, we are here to be salt and light. We are here to be ambassadors for Christ. And that which we reflect and that which we say and that which we do needs to be representative of Jesus, not not of our view of what the world's doing or our own carnality, but we need to be walking in the Spirit and reflecting what's true of Him. All right, so, and when we don't, this is what happens. And on all kinds of scales, this is what happened. Happens between husband and wife. Happens between brothers and sisters in Christ. Happens between parents and children. Happens in communities. Happens in countries. You understand what I'm saying? This is what happens. Because that's what Satan loves to do.
Jealousy can become hate, can it not?
Sure.
If left, you know, out of control over time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and you get on the thing where, well, God was jealous. Well, again, context means everything. God is not envious of anybody. Our jealousy is more of an envy, where God's jealousy is a jealousy of He loves us. And think about it this. His jealousy is a jealousy where He wants us to have His best. The kind of jealousy you ought to have for your spouse. I want my spouse to have God's best. My children, I want, you understand? So, all right, so verse 5. Thus the Jews defeated all their enemies with a strong sword. Verse 6. Now, and in Shushan and Citadel, Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. And you have a list of some of those men there in the next couple of verses. Verse 10. The 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedah, whatever. Thank you. The enemy of the Jews, they killed. But they did not lay a hand on the plunder. They didn't touch those things. They just, again, it was a defense. That's what's been given here. And on that day, the number of those who were killed in Shushan, the citadel, was brought to the king. And verse 12, and the king said to Queen Esther, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men in Shushan, the citadel, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your petition? And it shall be granted to you, or what is your further request, it shall be done. Then Esther said, if it pleases the king, let it be granted to the Jews who are in Shushan to do it again tomorrow according to today's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. So are these the 10 sons that are dead? Well, some people say that he had 20 sons. Others say that these are the 10 sons that were killed, but they are going to be put up on, remember the gallows, they are the spikes.
Yeah.
That as a testimony, they're going to be publicly displayed. Which was not an uncommon thing. If you remember Saul and his sons on the walls of Bethshan, their bodies were displayed there as a demonstration of conquest. Okay? So the king commanded this to be done. The decree was issued in Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. And the Jews who were in Shushan gathered together again on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 men in Shushan, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. The remainder of the Jews and the king's provinces gathered together and protected their lives, had rest from their enemies, and killed 75,000 of their enemies, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. Now, that statement is made, or they didn't lay a hand on the plunder. I want you to hear what that is, an indication that what they were doing was self-defense rather than conquest. Everybody get that picture in both those things? But think about the self-defense. 75,000 people were killed throughout all the provinces and stuff. But the Jewish people were not there to conquer, and they were not there just to get the kill these people and get their thing, which, by the way, was the decree the other way, remember? You go out, you kill the Jews, and then you take everything that they have. These people were saying, no, that's not what this is about. What this is about is we're given basically 2 days to defend ourselves. And that's what we're going to do. For 2 days, we're going to defend ourselves. But we're not. This is not about getting their stuff. It's not about overcoming a people. This is about protecting our own people.
I think a synonym for plunder these days would probably be loot.
Yeah.
Looting. And that is always so disgusting when you see people running into things that where the poor owners of the industries or the stores have to run for their lives, and then other bad people come in and loot.
Yeah. And again, that's something we've seen throughout history, where the looting is a part of all this. I think it's interesting, again, that that's not what this is about. This is about self-defense. Russ?
I don't know if you can, I don't think you can tell from the scripture, but just, you know, it said they killed 75,000 people. Jews killed 75,000 people. And it was in self-defense. Is there any way of knowing, were there any of the Jews that were killed in this battle, or was God protecting them?
I don't know. That's an interesting, I mean, I was reading this one in my chronological thing where Balaam and what was the name of the people that he was, the Moabites. And it talked about how God told Moses, send your guys to fight the Moabites. And they did bring back the plunder then. And when all the leaders got back, it records for us that the leaders of these fighting men, 1,000 from each tribe, came back and they said to Moses, we're bringing this offering to the Lord of all the gold and the silver and everything we got. They said, and we're bringing it to the Lord because we did not lose one man. So it's recorded there, but it's not recorded here. So, I mean, logic would tell us that probably there were some Jewish people killed too, but I don't know. Yeah. All right, verse 17. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day of the month, they rested and made it a day of feast and gladness. But the Jews who were in Shushan assembled together on the 13th day as well on the 14th day, and on the 15th day of the month, they rested and made it a day of feast and gladness. So, the extension was only for in the citadel, the capital, according to what it says here. It was only given one day, and on the 14th day, the next day, those in the provinces, they celebrated. But it was on the 15th day that those in the city celebrated. Verse 19, therefore the Jews of the villages who dwelt in the unwalled city celebrated the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day of gladness and feasting, as a holiday for sending presents to one another. It is a time of celebration. It is a time to send presents. And this is the establishment of a Jewish feast and celebration. It's not really a feast. It's more a celebration. It's called Purim. Remember, the Pur were the dice. So the Purim, and by the way, Purim is celebrated right about now. Right in this month time. I've been in Israel and celebrated Purim with them. It was a blast. And they recount the story here. Every time they say Haman, everybody boos and hisses and stuff. And every time they say Mordecai, everybody cheers, and they get their little things they twirl around and stuff like that. And then there has to be some ancient Baptist in them too, because after they finish the celebration, they eat. So they have a big potluck. So it's a celebration. Not so much of Esther, not even so much of Mordecai, but a celebration of God's protective hand and provision. Okay? So, verse 20, and Mordecai wrote these things and sent the letters to all the Jews who were in the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and the 15th days of the month of Adar. And as the days on which the Jews had rested from their enemies, as a month in which they turned from sorrow to joy and from mourning to holiday, and they should make them days of feasting and joy and sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted the custom which they had begun as Mordecai had written it. So the establishment of Purim is a celebration and established by Mordecai himself. Yes.
What season is it in?
Pardon me.
What season, like what month of...
It's right now.
It's right now. It's how does that relate to Passover?
It's prior to Passover.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. It usually falls in the weeks from the Christian calendar. It would fall in sometime in the time of what people call Lent. Okay? So it falls right in that time. Verse 24, but Haman, the son of Hammedath the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to annihilate them and had cast Pur, that is, the lot, to consume them and destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he had commanded by letter that the wicked plot which Haman had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Now again, he's recounting here what we've read this whole book, but that is the celebration of Purim. That's what those two verses actually describe for you, the celebration of Purim. So they called these days Purim, after the name Pur, again, which means lot. Therefore, because of all the words of this letter that they had seen concerning this matter and what had happened to them. The Jews established and imposed upon themselves and their descendants and all who should join them that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year according to the written instruction and according to the prescribed time. Now you say, well, why wouldn't it be the same time every year? It's just like Easter is not the same time every year because Easter coincides with Passover, and the Jewish people have a different calendar than the Gentiles do. We are the Gregorian calendar. They're under a lunar calendar. That's why for us, Easter moves around a little bit. It's not on the same day every year.
Well, I think that another reason for Easter being named when it is because of the tides.
Well, the tides are according to the lunar calendar.
Okay.
So, and the Jewish people hold a lunar calendar.
Okay.
But so it does coincide with the tides. That would be correct. But not, it's more specific to say it's tied with the lunar calendar according to Passover. Verse 29. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Ahasuerus, and with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm the second letter about Purim. And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, with the words of peace and truth, to confirm the days of Purim as their appointed time, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had prescribed them, and as they decreed for themselves and their descendants concerning the matters of fasting and lamenting. So the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in a book. Now, one of the shortest chapters, not the shortest chapter, one of the shortest chapters in the Bible, we have chapter 10. And King Ahasuerus issued tribute on the land and on the islands of the sea. Now all the acts of his power had and his might, and the account of the greatness of who? What's it say? Mordecai, to which the king advanced, are not they written in the book of the chronicles of the kings and of the Medes and the Persians? So they're not just written in the scripture, but also in the secular history. These are written. And again, it's all lining everything up for God's plan. The next one on the scene in the historical play is Nehemiah. And how does he get his place of prominence? Well, we see how God worked all that out. All right. Last verse says, for Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus, and was great among the Jews, and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people, and speaking peace to all his kindred. And you just did 3 chapters.
Wow.
So. Questions or comments on this book? I hope you've enjoyed Esther. It's a wonderful book, and again, reminds us, you know what? The schemes of men in any generation, you got to get this. The schemes of men in any generation cannot stand against our sovereign God. Now, that does not mean, and you got to understand, that does not mean that in the midst of these schemes that innocent people, even good people, might perish, might have to pay the consequences for bad decisions and all this. But when everything, that's why I love Revelation, when everything's said and done, I don't know what I'm going to have to go through personally. I don't know what you're going to have to go through personally. I do know this, whatever we go through, the Lord said He'll be there with us and give us what we needed. But when everything's said and done, the schemes of the evil one will not stand. That's the promise that we have. And though it seems like sometimes this temporal life is so long and hard, and particularly for some people that are going through some very hard things and have gone through hard things, eternity is our reward. And everything will be brought into perspective when we're finally in that place that God has prepared for us. And that's our hope. That's our hope. And without that hope, we would be a people that are most miserable. All right. With that said, after we leave, after I dismiss, if you have a New Testament book that you would like to go into next time, please let me know that. And I can't do all of them, so if I get 5 of them, I'll have to select one. But we're gonna in 2 weeks we'll start a New Testament book, and I'll try to get that out to you. So maybe you want to start reading ahead before that time also. Okay, let's pray.